and programs to make healthcare simpler. Online at healthinnumbers.com.
A lot happens between 9 and noon.
This isn't a short-term trend, it's a long-term trend.
It's unfortunate how this has become polarized.
I don't think that's where we need to be if we're going to expect our economy to grow.
This is the Daily Circuit on Minnesota Public Radio News.
I'm Carrie Miller, along with Tom Weber. This hour, atheism is rising in the country, even though many Americans are still reluctant to admit to it. Not Methodist Pastor Teresa McBain. She'll join us.
We also expect the state Senate to go into session anytime here to vote finally on the final Vikings bill. Reporter Tim Nelson will join us as well.
And in depth at 11, can terror suspects at Guantanamo Bay get fair trials? That's coming next hour.
First, a check of regional news. As I noted, the Minnesota Senate is expected to vote today on final passage of a bill to build a new stadium for the Vikings in Minneapolis. Even if the legislature and Governor Dayton sign off on the deal, the Minneapolis City Council still has final word. The council will have 30 days to approve it. Right now, 7 council members have said they'll vote yes, 6 say they'll vote no. Minneapolis Mayor R.T. Rybak supports the new stadium and says it's a good deal for the city. He told NPR's Morning Edition the council vote will be close, but he expects the plan to go through.
For the people in Minneapolis, this will continue to be the deal that will allow us to not only have a Viking stadium, but renovate Target Center and take that off our property taxes. So there's a lot of good stuff in here, and I don't anticipate there will be a change.
Rybak says the stadium deal will not raise property taxes for city residents. It also includes a provision leading to the hiring of women and minority workers, and the city would get a portion of the profit if the team were sold. 2 young people have killed themselves in the past 2 weeks in southeastern Minnesota. While the cases are very different, the suicides have prompted an outpouring of grief and discussions about bullying. Elizabeth Baer reports.
13-year-old Rachel Emke from Manterville took her own life last week after she faced bullying at school. And 17-year-old J. Corey Jones jumped off a bridge in Rochester and died earlier this week. Jones was openly gay, and family and friends say bullying played a role in his death, too. School officials, community activists, and students are grappling with how to prevent the kind of bullying that played a role in the 2 deaths. District leaders say they're doing everything they can to help students who might be suicidal. Funeral services for Jones will be held on Saturday in Chicago. His dad is planning a vigil in Rochester in the next few weeks. Elizabeth Baer, Minnesota Public Radio News, Rochester.
The mother of Minnesota Gophers football player who died last month will accept her son's diploma today. Gary Tinsley earned a degree in business and marketing. An autopsy shows the 22-year-old had an enlarged heart when he died. And that is the latest news here on the Daily Circuit, but we return now for a moment to the Vikings, Carrie.
That's right, Tom. What else?
What else are we going to talk about?
We know the state Senate's in session, or going to be in session this morning. The Vikings stadium bill is on their agenda. The bill now includes an additional $50 million from the Vikings, and it brings their contribution to close to half of the cost of the new facility. Tim Nelson, yet again, he's been covering this story for months and months, and he's back at the state capitol. And hi, Tim, it's good to talk to you.
Hi, Carrie.
Late night last night?
No, actually, I left about 5:30 this morning. So.
Early morning this morning.
That's
well, welcome.
Right.
It's good to have you here. So I have to say, Tim, that watching how quickly this new deal got put together on the stadium made me wonder if the Vikings always had more money in their back pocket and they were prepared to spend it if they had to. What do you think?
I think you aren't the only one that was wondering that. You know, on the day before yesterday, when these extra charges got tacked onto the Vikings bill as it went through the House and Senate, it was interesting to watch the Senate author, Julie Rosen, accept the $25 million additional charge. Senator Jeremy Miller offered it. She did not blink. She
really?
Just accepted it and said, good, we're good to go. They passed that, and she came out and said the Vikings are good for the other $25 million. So there's one little indication that they had they might have had a little extra change in the couch cushions there. The other thing that's interesting here is the Senate eliminated the soccer provisions here. The Vikings came back and put them back in, and there's a couple little interesting things there. The estimate is that they're going to have to pay about $40 million for a soccer franchise, and they have said a retractable roof is a must-have for that team. Mm-hmm. That's another $40 million charge that they may put into the stadium. They may put a retractable feature, as they call it, into the stadium.
Wow.
So there may be another $80 million that the Vikings are going to bring to this site as it gets built.
And so, Tim, wouldn't that take them then up above 50% of the cost? And where does that fit, I wonder if you know this, nationwide with stadiums?
It really runs the gamut. You know, for instance, in Indianapolis, it was pretty much entirely publicly funded compared to Boston, where the Patriots owner built that. So it's a wide variation. This is, as the Vikings say, the third largest private contribution. It sort of stays in that rank among NFL stadiums. There, when you're talking $1 billion, you know, $50 million here and there isn't going to really move the needle that much.
The naming rights stayed with them?
They did. There was a lot of discussion about that about 4 o'clock this morning, or about 3 o'clock this morning. Representative Alice Hausman from St. Paul said, you know, look, we're putting the biggest single chunk of money as the state of Minnesota into this stadium. You know, the NFL's putting a loan in, there's some naming rights coming in, things like that. The great irony is, she says, that someone else's name will be on the building when it's finished, even though the taxpayers and the public put the greatest single chunk of money in.
Yeah.
There's some objection to that, but they kind of swallowed hard and approved it anyway.
And how much has there been discussion, perhaps off the floors, Tim, about how much that's worth?
There's a great deal of speculation. As you may recall, Tom Weber and I talked a month ago about how experts think this will look much like the Target Field deal. That was reported to be $125 million over 25 years. Forbes says, you know, these deals are typically $5 or $6 million a year. Now, you spread that over 25, 30 years, you have to kind of do the inflation calculation. That'll run about $60 million. So, you know, we were estimating the team might have $115-120 million of their own money, mm-hmm. or money that we can't account for in this deal. So now they're up to maybe 160 of cash that we can't account for in some other way.
I see. Representative Tina Liebling, who did not vote for the bill on the House floor, told her colleagues, "I think the state got rolled. Our constituents got rolled." I'm interested in whether you think this turns out to be an election year issue.
I it can't help but do that. I mean, we've seen a lot of discussion about the fate of this bill and where the money's coming from. You know, the other interesting thing is, the St. Paul delegation came in. The majority of the St. Paul delegation came in favor of this stadium, even though it improved Target Center and gave it a more competitive position to St. Paul's Arena, the X.
Well, explain that, Tim.
Well, I had a story on the Capitol View yesterday that Senator Sandy Pappas said, "That's right, we want the Saints Stadium." And our discussions with the governor led us to believe that it will be looked on much more favorably if we put the votes up. If we put the votes up for the Vikings stadium, I had her quoted pretty extensively about that in that story. So, I mean, there is some raw politics.
I was going to say, oh, the horse trading, the sausage making, right? If we only saw it.
But it has been quite visible up here. I mean, it's unusually on view during the Viking Stadium debate.
You know, well, I was going to ask you, Tim, if this is there has been a stadium either in the works or before the state lawmakers for more than a decade. And I was going to ask you, is this finally the end of the stadium issue? But it sounds like not if the Saints are coming in.
Well, in theory, you know, there's in the bonding bill, there's a $50 million economic development fund. St. Paul believes that they're going to be eligible for a matching grant or a matching fund out of that. And so that could finish this off. They could do that without legislative approval. In theory, the Dayton administration could give them that and we could be done. What would we do?
What would you do, Tim, with all your free time?
That's right. Mm.
Hey, we really appreciate all the time that you've devoted to us, to the Daily Circuit, and leading us through this issue. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Tim Nelson with us from the state capitol. State Senate, I should say, not yet in session, but when they are, they will take up the Viking Stadium bill. And you heard Tim talking a little bit there about some of the horse trading that has gone on behind the scenes. More coverage on it, of course, on NPR News and online through the day. now in depth on atheism. We've spent a considerable amount of time this week talking about trends in faith communities and changing values and perspectives around religion. This hour, we're going to talk about why an increasing number of Americans say they're affiliated with no organized religion. It's one of the fastest growing groups in the country. We're also going to talk about atheism, Americans who not only don't identify with a faith, but don't believe in a higher power. Why are some Americans still reluctant to admit to atheism? Why do many Americans equate a lack of morality with atheism? I think that's something we need to explore this morning as well. So for you, are you an atheist? What happens when you tell friends and coworkers about that? And if you're one of the growing number of Americans who doesn't identify with any faith, tell us about how you reached that place. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. Our conversation will go on at facebook.com/NPR News. Talk to me a little bit about your growing awareness of your atheism. And is it something that you don't necessarily tell a lot of people about? 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. And I know the conversation has already gotten going on Facebook, so it's a good place to get in on it. Our guest this hour, Teresa McBain, is a former senior pastor at Lake Jackson United Methodist Church in Tallahassee, Florida. She recently revealed that she is an atheist, and she's with us from Tallahassee. And Teresa, thank you so much for the time today.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's my pleasure.
And Greta Christina is with us. She's a blogger and a speaker and an atheist, and she's the author of Why Are You Atheists So Angry? And she's with us from San Francisco. And Greta, welcome. It's good to talk with you as well.
Thank you so much. And Teresa, it's a great honor to meet you, even just over the radio.
Yeah, same for me. Thank you, Greta.
Teresa, I have to say, your story's pretty extraordinary, because not only were you living as a person of faith, you were guiding members of your congregation in their faith. And yet, as that was happening, your own faith was vanishing. So how long of a process was this as you were wrestling with this?
Looking back, it's always easier to see the progression. The old saying, hindsight's 20/20. While I was going through it, I didn't realize exactly what was happening. I knew I was dealing with matters of faith and struggling. And I think most anyone who's in a religious circle or in a faith group will agree that there's certain things that are really difficult to accept. The problem of evil, contradictions in the Bible. And I started dealing with those with the intention that I would uncover the answers for myself and be able to help others as they struggled. But the problem with that was, is the more I dug in and the more I read and the more I researched, just as you said, it caused my own faith to start crumbling. And it probably wasn't until the last few years that I really allowed myself to open the doors wide and read from a variety of things, from science text, archaeological, just outside of that Christian bubble, so to speak. And within the last years, when it really dawned on me just how far I'd gone, which led up to my coming out in March of this year.
You know, as I was reading what you've said about this, I was thinking, you know, this isn't just a change in a belief system. It's a change in your entire identity in a way and worldview. I mean, doesn't this change what you think about, you know, where humanity fits in the world and maybe the philosophy that guides all of us? I mean, has it changed that for you?
Yeah, I think it has, in a sense that when you're involved, I'll just speak from my perspective because I don't want to insult anyone in their own faith. Our journeys are our own, and we have to make the choices we make because of what we believe. So for me, I look to this divine power to be a guiding force, to be something that I based my life on, my principles, my worldview, the way I thought about certain issues such as war or homosexuality or abortion or any of the hot topics. Now that that piece is taken away, I see life and my own personal life and humanity as I'm responsible for those things. I make decisions. I have to do the hard work. I can't just say a prayer and wait for an answer. I have to, you know, look. If I'm going to buy a car, I need to go research it. I'm not going to be praying and saying, okay, God, lead me to the perfect car. So the worldview shifts to a personal responsibility view.
You know, it's interesting, though, to hear you describe that, because you make it sound like you lived a kind of passive existence in this faith. And I don't maybe that's not the right description, but I don't hear a lot of people think of it that way.
I don't think people do, and I know that I didn't. Throughout faith, being raised in the church, reading the scriptures, they lend that type of thought process that, yes, we're human beings, and yes, we have free will and choice, but the perfect path is in God's will. And that's where every Christian, which is the only path I can speak from, seeks to live their life following God's will, God's plan, and God's purpose. And in a sense, it really is more of a passive viewpoint. And it takes away the majority of that personal responsibility, as I spoke of a moment ago.
Let me go to the phones here to Elizabeth in Hibbing. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hey, I wanted to comment. I think that is wonderful that you came out with honesty. I am a Christian. I'm a scientific Christian. And I am pretty much rejected by most churches. And I just wanted to say, I think that is beautiful that you're searching and wanted to know the answers. Missing in the church is that people go by traditions, or they go by this. They don't even want to research anything to see if it's true. Hello?
Yeah, go ahead, Elizabeth.
Oh, okay,
yeah.
I'm sorry.
No.
I happen to I wasn't raised in the church at all. My mother was Pantheistic, whatever. I can say I'm a layperson. Very, very logical, very scientific. They were not dogmatized. I was not dogmatized. I never wanted to be. My personal experience is being pulled into it by having miraculous things happen. And that is, I think, for a person, that unless they have that proof, which is that actually scripturally says that that faith is supposed to produce, you know, of course, as the, you know, accurate and researched, it's supposed to produce results, supposed to bring evidence. And I think that it is a shame for this dogmatized church to present a conflict with science, and number two, to say that people can't search it out.
Elizabeth, forgive me for stopping you there. You've brought up some really good points, and I want to give our guests a chance to talk about that. Teresa, to what Elizabeth has said, and then I'll turn to Greta.
I think it's an interesting point of view that she is a scientific Christian, and I actually completely understand that. I think at one point in my journey, I would have considered myself a scientific Christian, doing researching and reading and studying and trying to make, for me personally, make the two mesh.
Mm-hmm.
And the faith I was raised in, and the doctrine and dogma, evolution didn't fit into the picture at all. And yet you read in the science text and you look at the research, especially over the last 50, 100, 150 years, I personally don't see a way that you can deny that the evolutionary process and many other processes, just that's for an example. I also find it and understand completely how she could be rejected by the churches because of this, because there is, in the majority of religious faiths, this taboo of questioning, or this taboo of reading outside the little bubble. I remember being in a church 6-8 years ago when the Da Vinci Code came out, and I was an associate pastor, the pastor stood up from the pulpit and said, don't read that book, don't watch that movie, that will harm your mind. You need to keep your minds pure. So the message is, don't question. Stick within your boundaries.
Greta, is that where it started for you, asking some of these hard questions, not being able to reconcile some of the answers? And do you think that's where it starts for many atheists?
I think it's where it starts for many atheists. Certainly, I've done a lot of asking questions of other atheists on my own blog. I've asked my readers to comment about why they became an atheist, what led them out of religion, if they were ever religious to begin with. And what I've found is that very often people who have come to atheism are people who took religion most seriously and who really wanted to understand it, who really cared about whether the things they believed were true and weren't willing to just accept what they were told by their parents or by their religious leaders or by their religious books and so on. It's, you know, the people who have come to atheism are to a great extent people who really wrestled with these questions and really struggled with them. And that was certainly true for me. I'm a little bit of an unusual story in that I was raised as a non-believer. My parents were non-believers. And they said, we're going to let the kids make up their own mind, which is, I think, an excellent thing to do. The place where they fell down on the job a little bit was that they didn't arm me and my brother with the critical thinking skills for how to make up, you know, they said, we're going to let their kids make up their own minds. They didn't really give us the critical thinking skills to do that. They didn't explain to us why they had left religion. And so when I got to college, I picked up a lot of New Age beliefs, a lot of spiritual but not religious beliefs, you know, things like astrology and tarot cards and reincarnation and the sort of westernized mishmash of Eastern religions, that whole thing. And I definitely had to go through a process of letting that go. And definitely what it involved was really caring passionately about, were the things that I believed really true? And I was starting to read about neurology and neuropsychology and how the mind works and realizing, you know, all these beliefs I have about a soul, about consciousness being somehow separate from the body, it's really just not supported by the evidence. And that's true for a lot of atheists. A lot of there's a myth about atheists that, you know, we reject religion just somewhat casually or because we don't like the rules that religion imposes on us. And that's really not the case. For most atheists, they actually take the question of religion very seriously, and they take questions about right and wrong very seriously.
Greta Christina is one of our guests this morning as we talk about atheism. She's a blogger and a speaker and the author of Why Are You Atheists So Angry? And Teresa McBain is with us this morning. She's a former senior pastor at Lake Jackson United Methodist Church in Tallahassee, and she has recently gone public with her atheism. Very full phone lines here. I want to know, though, about your how you came to this, your thought process. Were you like Teresa describes, asking some tough questions, being unable to reconcile the answers with some of your other beliefs about that? Were you in an experience like Greta has just described? Your parents, you didn't grow up in a church, and your parents really said, make up your own mind. How open are you about your atheism? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, facebook.com/NPR News. Good conversation going on there, Steph, and we knew it would be lively. What are people saying?
It's really lively. A lot of atheists weighing in. Sean says, why does it have to be called a lack of faith? How about an abundance of humanity or something like that? I, for one, have plenty of faith in what I believe, which happens to not include your God. And Mike Carlson says the reason why he thinks that more you're hearing more from atheists, he says, maybe, and like him, he says, maybe it's because my eyes are more open because I'm older, but it seems that religious folks are getting more and more extreme in their beliefs, and the more, consequently, atheists are speaking out. I know in my family specifically, people are going off the deep end and expecting the world to end any day now.
To the phones to Billy in Duluth. Hi, Billy. Thank you for waiting.
Hi, Carrie. How's it going? Love the show. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks.
So many places to start with. First of all, I don't tell people outside of, you know, certain circles about my atheism.
Why not?
Just for what I do for business, it just wouldn't be good for business. And I'll say that's all I'll say on that.
Okay.
But you know what I mean? Like, it would severely affected if that was the kind of shirt I walked in with and people knew, not saying I'd wear a shirt, but if people knew, that would affect the business big time. Sometimes I struggle with the actual term of atheism because I feel that it's a term that religious people use for us in the sense that, oh, he's an atheist. He doesn't believe in God. Like, God's there. I just don't believe in him because I'm mad at him or whatever. What I prefer is non-theist, no God. And that's why people say, well, why are you an atheist or why are you a non-theist? And I say, well, it's easy. There's no God. And there never has been, never will be. And that's that. You say that, and that's what gets people upset, almost like you're saying, well, they're stupid. They're fools. They've been duped. And, you know, when you break it down, and you get into those arguments, that is ultimately what the conclusion is yes, we feel that religious people have been duped. And I struggle with that. And that would be my question to the pastor who came out.
Sure.
Is how have you been taken in by the atheist community? You know, I mean, we'll take anybody we can get kind of thing. But at the same time, you were a peddler of this, you know, I'll use the word smut, for so long. You helped bring down or in whatever case diminish, you know, chances of people actually gaining free thought. You know, so have you had to, you know, come to terms with this with the atheist community?
Go ahead, Teresa.
It's interesting that you asked that question. First of all, I would encourage you, and I'm not trying to be self-promoting here, but look up on YouTube the American Atheist Convention 2012, where I came out. The one thing when I stood up on the stage and faced a crowd of 1,500, 2,000 atheists, the one thing that was on my mind was the very fact that I had been a pastor, that I had spoken out against atheism and categorized and marginalized anyone who didn't have a faith, not only in God, but in any other God besides my God at the moment. So my thought was that I needed to apologize. And that's exactly how I came out, was apologizing for all those years of being a conservative fundamentalist, being misunderstanding, not wanting to understand, not even wanting to know anything about atheist, just the fact that someone didn't believe in God made them evil, and that was good enough for me at that point. As far as how the atheist community has received me, let me just say it has been mind-blowing. The crowd, as soon as I stood up and began to apologize, and I didn't take very much time at all to do it. You know, how long does it take to say I'm sorry? They stood on their feet, and people wept and clapped for, it seemed like, an eternity, and I was so moved by the response. I've had so many people contact me, friend me on Facebook, or follow me on Twitter, and there are a few that are opposed, or a few Christians that are trying to preach to me to reconvert me, but the majority have been such supportive messages,
you know,
people identifying with my position and just offering their love and encouragement.
You know, Teresa, I want to be candid with you. And by the way, we have that link on the Daily Circuit homepage so you can see what Teresa's talking about at this convention. I have to say, when I heard the reaction, and I think I heard it somewhere else on NPR, I felt a little uncomfortable with that because I thought, you've gone through a profound change here. I mean, your life has really been upended. And there was a very kind of raucous, celebratory feel to that. Now, maybe that's just me. You in the room, it sounds like that was meaningful to you. But I was kind of taken aback by this in thinking that I don't think this is going to be all. I mean, it probably hasn't been easy so far, and I don't think it's going to be very easy for you.
Oh, no, it definitely hasn't been easy for anyone who comes out, as the caller said, and uses that word, atheism. Even someone who just says, no, I don't attend church. Why don't you attend church? Well, I don't believe in God. It's very, very difficult. For me personally, 44 years wrapped up in Christian circles and Christian ministry. When I first came out, and even now, I'm struggling to try to figure out how I'm supposed to live my life because music, reading, thought process, study every day, research, preparing sermons, visiting people, everything in my life revolved around faith and religion. And so I have gone through this huge metamorphosis, an identity change, and it will take me some time to discover where I am. Also, I just wanted to say one thing about your statement of feeling uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
My feeling was when I was standing there, the celebration of sorts was not necessarily because I had come into the atheist fold, although there probably was some of that. I think that the crowd really responded to my honesty and my openness, and seeing someone in my position, having been a pastor, having been this minister, being so, I guess humble would be the word, and actually apologizing to them. You have to think about the crowd. Most of them have come out of a religious community, and they have been rejected and ostracized and scorned and experienced all the negativity that all of us who've come out experience. And so to have a pastor standing there and say, I'm sorry that I treated you that way. I mean, can you imagine just how emotional that would be for you?
And that, Greta, that makes sense. Do you understand why I'm asking about it, Greta? And tell me what you think about what Teresa's saying.
I can certainly understand why you'd react that way, but I can actually speak to that because I was one of those people who was standing and cheering. I was at that convention. I was one of the people who heard Teresa spoke, and I was one of the people who was incredibly moved by it. And I don't think it was so much rah-rah, we got another one for our ranks. I mean, I suppose there was a certain amount of that. But mostly what it was, I think, and speaking for myself and speaking for my wife who was also there and speaking for other people who were there that I talked to, we understand just how difficult it is to come out as an atheist for anybody. And we especially understand how difficult it is for somebody in Teresa's position, you know, when you're very deeply entrenched with religion, when your very livelihood is entwined with religion, when people look up to you because you're religious, you know, because you're a religious leader, that's extraordinarily difficult to come out as an atheist. It's difficult for anybody. It's especially difficult for somebody in Teresa's position. And in order to come out, in order for Teresa to come out or anybody in her position to come out, takes a tremendous amount of courage. It takes a tremendous amount of honesty. It takes a willingness to prioritize the truth over your own personal well-being. And that's something that a lot of atheists really treasure. One of the things that I've found among the atheists that I know in this community is that, and obviously there's exceptions to this, but on the whole, this is a community that really deeply values truth and that really deeply values honesty. And what we saw in Teresa was somebody who was at great personal expense to herself saying, I care about what's true and I'm willing to take a risk and I'm willing to lose my community. I'm willing to lose my livelihood. I'm willing to alienate the people who are closest to me in order to say what's true for me. That was just tremendously moving and tremendously inspiring.
I'm really glad we talked about this because now I think I understand that. And I've been thinking about it since I heard it. So if you're just tuned in this hour, we're talking about atheism as our continued week's focus on faith and public life. I'd like to hear a bit about the story of your own atheism. And I'd like to know how freely you talk about it. Do you tell people, coworkers, friends, even other family members? If so, what's the reaction? If not, why not? Tell me about that. Good discussion going on at facebook.com/NPR News. A look at the latest news now from Tom Weber. Hey, Tom.
Hi, Carrie. Russia's Secret Service says it has foiled plans for a terror attack in the Black Sea resort of Sochi ahead of the 2014 Winter Games. Russian officials say agents discovered caches of ammunition, portable surface-to-air missiles, grenade launchers, flamethrowers, and explosives in a breakaway Republic of Georgia. President Obama says Mitt Romney is having an etch-a-sketch moment when he claims credit for the revival of the U.S. auto industry. Obama says people must remember that Romney's stance, rather, was that Detroit should have been allowed to go bankrupt. Obama says he doesn't think anybody takes seriously Romney's insistence this week that he deserves credit for the auto industry's success. Romney wrote in a 2008 editorial that if the Obama administration's auto bailout were enacted, you can kiss the American automotive industry goodbye. The number of people applying for U.S. unemployment benefits ticked down last week after dropping sharply the previous week. It's evidence that hiring could be picking up this month. The Labor Department says weekly applications dropped 1,000 to a seasonally adjusted 367,000. The previous week's figures were revised up slightly. And the flame that will burn during the London Games has been lit. A Greek Olympic swimmer was the first of 490 torchbearers who will carry the flame across 1,800 miles of Greek soil before it's handed to London organizers next week in Athens. More coming up here on the Daily Circuit.
Programming on Minnesota Public Radio is supported by Bremer Bank, providing guidance and financial solutions to help people, businesses, and communities build a better future for more than 100 years. You can learn more at bremer.com.
Support for this program comes from MinnesotaWorks.net, Minnesota's no-fee online job bank, designed to be used by all, whether looking for your next employee or looking for a perfect job using advanced technology at MinnesotaWorks.net.
Friday and Morning Edition. The walleye openers this weekend, and some anglers are concerned about proposed fishing restrictions on Lake Mille Lacs. I'm Kathy Werzer. We'll have that story and the latest news weekdays from 4 to 9 a.m. on Minnesota Public Radio News.
Call in with your comments, 651-227-6000 or 800-242-2828. This is The Daily Circuit on Minnesota Public Radio News.
I'm Carrie Miller, and we're talking about atheism this morning. Good discussion going on at Facebook.com. And Steph Curtis, what are people saying?
Robin tells the story of how she became an atheist, which was really from the moment she was born, it sounds like. She says, growing up with a Catholic mother and a Jewish father, my brother and I were nullified to religion. So when the discussion of religion comes up between my friends and I'm usually pegged as being defensive about my lack of religion and my atheism. But I think it is in response to always being questioned about my belief and needing to explain why I don't believe in organized religion that I seem defensive. Why can't it be that people don't want religious affiliations? Why must there be an explanation?
Teresa, this is one of the questions that I'm really interested in, is why this equation, and perhaps you believe this as well, that atheists are amoral somehow, that if they don't have a faith system, then they don't have a clear guidance or kind of a true north on morality. Did you believe that? And give me some insight into what you now know about that.
I'm ashamed to say that I did believe that. And it stems from the fact that religious groups base their morality upon a sacred text, which is an experience with a divine being that dictates to them, which for Christians, the Ten Commandments, the other laws that are contained in the Old Testament, even in the New Testament. And so if that's where a person is gaining all their moral teachings and their moral structures from, if I, as an atheist, don't look to supernatural or a divine being or a sacred text, then the question is, well, where do you get your morality? Morality comes from God. Well, I don't personally believe that now, because I understand that humanity has the sense of morality within them. I don't need anyone anywhere to tell me that if I take someone's life, that it's wrong. Mm-hmm. Life is sacred. We all know that. Life is valuable. Let me just slip out of my religious speak there. Mm-hmm. It's a little difficult translation for me. Mm-hmm. Life is very valuable and precious to all of us. And no one needs to be told that murder or rape or theft or even being malicious towards someone is wrong. We know that as human beings.
Let me take a call here from Tiara in St. Paul. Hi. Thanks so much for waiting.
Yeah, no problem.
Go right ahead.
I was actually an out atheist as an elementary school student.
Were you really?
I was, and it was really difficult to be told on a daily basis by my friends that I was going to burn in hell.
I guess.
Or my best friend was a very conservative Christian who at one point told me she thought I had been sent by the devil to test her faith.
Wow. Oh, my gosh.
As I was growing up, I became very active in the Unitarian Universalist Church, and I was a church accompanist there.
Uh-huh.
And now I describe myself as a non-theist Christian Quaker. What's interesting to me is that my theology, as it were, hasn't really changed. There are different labels that cover the same me.
But wait a minute. You say, so when you add Christian to the label, what are you saying?
I really like Jesus.
But do you believe that Jesus was the Son of God?
No, and that's where I get into arguments with other people who may consider themselves Christian, but I decided, actually, being raised by secular humanists who are a little bit freaked out at how much I loved Jesus, I decided that Christians don't get to own Jesus. So he can be mine, too, and it's a big part of my personal faith, but one that includes a divine presence.
I think we could have done the whole hour just with you, Tiara. this is complicated. And interesting. So, but I mean, that whole experience in elementary school, you were clearly not scarred by that, or you've gotten over it.
Yeah, and what was fascinating to me is that my extremely conservative Christian friend and I were really drawn together because we were the outskirts.
Huh.
We were not the norm.
Yeah.
And her parents actually found scripture basis for the presence of a good non-believer in their daughter's life.
Hmm. No.
Because I would not allow people to pick on her for her belief.
Something.
Any more than I would allow them to pick on me for my lack of belief.
There's a book in there somewhere, Tiara.
Yeah.
I think so. Hey, thank you so much for the call.
Yep, thank you.
You know, Greta, I want to come back to you on this question of morality. I'm sure you've thought a lot about it. I was reading something that you wrote recently on your blog about death and how this can be very isolating for atheists.
Well, it can be. And certainly the story that Tiara was telling about growing up atheist and being an out atheist as a child and being told that she's going to burn in hell, that she's a terrible person, etc. I think that this points to one of the main reasons that people do think of atheists as being immoral mm-hmm. is because atheists are afraid to come out of the closet. People think that they don't know any atheists and therefore they're free to believe whatever myths or stigmas are told about us. And I think that one of the main reasons that people think that atheists are immoral and so on, don't have any meaning in our lives, you know, are bitter, are selfish, are unhappy, etc., is that they think they don't know any atheists. And I think that a lot of what's missing from that conversation is just the reality of atheists' lives. And I think the more atheists who are able to come out of the closet and tell our stories, the more people will know us and the more people will understand that, in fact, you don't need God to be good. And that was certainly true for the LGBT community. And one of the things that you find is that the factor that predicts most accurately whether people will support gay rights is whether they know a gay person, or rather whether they know that they know a gay person.
Mm.
And I think that's certainly true for atheists. Back to the question of death.
Yeah.
Certainly, the experience of being an atheist can, again, be very isolating just generally, again, because a lot of us have to stay in the closet, and there's a lot of stigma and hostility against us. And that's often especially true during death. You know, the way that atheists deal with death and with grief is very different from the way that religious believers deal with death and grief. I mean, obviously, there's commonalities. We're all human beings. We all, you know, feel tremendous loss and tremendous sadness and often anger and so on when the people we love die. But there are real differences in the way that religious believers and atheists deal with it. And there's actually an online support group. It's on Facebook called Grief Beyond Belief. And a friend of mine, Rebecca Hensler, founded that group because she found when she was grieving the death of her son that the kind of support that's often offered, that's very reflexively offered to people who are grieving, is very much rooted in religion. You know, people say, "Oh, you'll see them again someday. They're in a better place."
Yeah.
You know, God wanted another angel, and so on. And if you're an atheist, that's very isolating and that's very alienating. And many of these ideas are very upsetting. And atheists who aren't out of the closet are put in a very difficult position when you're grieving the loss and you're, you know, going through that terrible experience and people are offering you these religious consolations, you really have two choices. Either you have to just shut up and just take it and, you know, just listen to these ideas that you find upsetting and alienating, or you have to come out of the closet and say, "Actually, I don't believe that," and risk losing the people in your life at the very time that you need them
most. Who want to be comforting. But you know, Teresa, I mean, I see the connection here between this idea that atheists are somehow amoral and the end of your life, supposedly, right? You're leading a moral life because it's the right thing to do and it's what the sacred text says. But it is also all leading up to that moment of the end of your life and your judgment day. Yes?
Yes, that is exactly what religious teaching puts forth, is that everything is on this earth is done with a view toward the afterlife. And the afterlife is going to possess one of two situations. Either you followed the moral code dictated by your sacred text, and you will be rewarded and lauded, and you know, the whole streets of gold floating on a cloud, enjoying the presence of God every day, or you will be judged if you didn't follow that path, and you will be tormented.
Right.
And honestly, this was one of the big pieces of the puzzle that really led me toward losing or finding my faith, fighting my freedom. I can't remember how the caller phrased it. Was the thought that the divine creator, and at this point I still believed that there was a God, I was somewhat of an agnostic, that this divine being, this God who loves us and who created us, I thought about it from a parent's perspective. We are created in the image of God. He loves us. We have these human frailties. The scripture teaches that we can't know the ways of God because he's higher than we are and his thoughts are higher than ours. So why in the world would he ever torment someone for an eternity for stumbling around for 80 years or so and not finding the exact right path? That would be like me taking my son when he's younger and reaches for the stove and say, well, you just reach for the stove. I need to teach you a lesson about this. I told you already that you don't do that. So here, let me just burn you, and then you'll never forget that the stove is hot. I mean, the ends don't justify the means. So
Go ahead.
I'm sorry.
Well, I just want to jump in here and say that this idea that people have to have the desire for heaven and the fear for hell in order to be moral, you know, that's the idea, right, behind, you know, atheists don't have any morality. So I think that's not only insulting to atheists, I think it's insulting to believers. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you ask a believer, if I could prove to you beyond a shadow of a doubt with 100% certainty that there was no God, would you start murdering people? Would you start raping people? Would you start stealing? You know, would you just do anything you wanted to do? And overwhelmingly, what they say is no. No, I wouldn't do that. I know what's right and wrong. I know, you know, and there's certainly a tremendous amount of evidence that human beings are a social species, and we evolved as a social species with this, you know, sense of ethics so that we could cooperate and function as a you know, in a society. And the I think it's tremendously insulting, not just to atheists, but to believers, to say the only reason that you do good things is so that you can get goodies in heaven and you will not get punished in hell after you die. That's denying that they have compassion. It's denying that they have a sense of justice. It's denying that they have any kind of, you know, understanding of what hurts other people or concern about that. And I don't think that's true for atheists, and I don't think it's true for believers.
If you're tuned in this hour, we're talking about atheism with two guests. Teresa McBain is with us. She's the former senior pastor at Lake Jackson United Methodist Church in Tallahassee and recently went public with her atheism. And Greta Christina is here. She's a blogger and a speaker, writes about atheism online. To the phone. Oh, I'm sorry. And good conversation, I should say, going on at Facebook.com. And I want to hear about it from Steph Curtis. Hi, Steph.
Hi. David from St. Paul says the belief that God does not exist and all of the rhetorical constructs set in place to support that belief are themselves a system of belief. That belief system is no more or less valid than any other belief system. I personally do not care what one believes as long as their actions reflect goodwill towards their fellow human beings and the universe at large. And Danielle says, I'm a lifelong atheist raised in a Roman Catholic family. I was pressured into faking the Christian confirmation process in order to appease my conservative relatives. It pains me that I have to live a lie in order to be on good terms with the people I love.
Here's Lydia in Duluth online. She says, I don't mind saying I'm atheist. It's amusing that people don't believe me. It's not as if atheists are evil. My values and life are very mainstream. Here's Tim in St. Paul who says, I'm a gay atheist. Talk about a double whammy. I've been jumping through closets all my life, it seems, to Jeanette in Avon. Hi, Jeanette. I really appreciate you waiting.
Thank you. I call myself a Catholic atheist. I have a master's degree in doctrine, or it's called systematic theology. I go to church regularly. I write about religion, but I agree more with atheists than with Christians.
How can that be, Jeanette?
Pardon me?
How can that be?
Well, I believe that most advanced theologians and mystics actually have more in common with atheists than with most Christians, because we don't believe literally. The subject of your recent conversations, we don't believe that nonsense. God is not a God. It's certainly not a he. All the gods of religion are God images or ways that people imagine this mysterious something that we cannot comprehend. It's all about interpreting doctrines. Reading them literally is nonsense. Years ago, I said to a lesbian, this is before the recent evolution in these movements, years ago I said to a lesbian, it's harder for me to come out as a Catholic who doesn't believe Jesus is God than for you to come out as a lesbian. And she agreed.
I want to put this to Teresa McBain, though, what you were saying about the literal interpretations and maybe the agreement more with mystics and theologians. Teresa, do you buy that argument?
I would say, let me speak first to a theological training.
Okay.
During my time at Duke, when I was getting my divinity degree, I would agree with what she's saying. Several professors that I could name off, and I will not do that, were definitely agnostic.
Really?
Several were, I would consider, atheists. And at the time when I was there, it was really shocking to me. And that probably pushed me a little further along the path, at least as far as openly exploring just some of the arguments and some of the discussions, which are very lengthy and I won't go into on the air, were really, for a young Baptist girl raised up in the South, they were pretty traumatic. And a lot of people that I've talked to, especially through the Clergy Project, who have had time in seminary, share that very same thing, that they came in and had a certain set of beliefs and values, and then the theology classes and the systematic theology the caller was talking about exposed a lot of gaps and historical inaccuracies and scientific inaccuracies. So I do believe that that's a very, very real occurrence.
You found that shocking because you felt that if you were going to approach this from theology from a scholarly standpoint, you had to be a believer too.
Yeah, absolutely. Obviously, in my mind anyway, and I've been told I've always been too logical and always been too analytical, and I've been told that that was my downfall. Mm-hmm. But in my mind, if you're going to be a representative, a spiritual leader, someone who trains others to do so, then you have to come from the basic premise that the text you're teaching from is a true text. Now, I have been living in hiding for several months, for many months actually, and doing just what I'm talking about, teaching from a text that I no longer believed. So even saying this, I self-identify as a hypocrite. But it's just my belief in that, and I guess that's why it was so shocking to find out that I'm being trained for a specific ministry. I'm being trained to go and to teach the Bible, to teach the principles and doctrines, and yet the scholars, the theologians that are teaching me, don't believe what they're saying. It's kind of interesting.
It is. Online here, Greta from Dana North Branch, who says, Americans are 1.6% atheist, yet it's treated as equivalent to, or nearly so, other faiths. It's the tiniest of minorities given major status by this show. Would you argue, I think you argued earlier that there are more atheists out there than we know, but they don't want to go public.
There are a lot more atheists out there than we know. I'm not sure about the numbers that she's looking at, but certainly the numbers that I've seen are that atheists are, in fact, a very significant minority in this country. Atheists, especially if you expand that to atheists, agnostics, non-theists, non-believers, there's a lot of people who are non-believers but who are afraid to use the word atheist because the word atheist has a lot of stigma around it, but who, when you ask them, do you believe in God, they say, well, no, when you press them on their beliefs. So I do think that there are many more atheists than we know about because people are afraid to come out. And the stories that Teresa was just telling, there's this phenomenon of people who are in the leadership, who are religious leaders, who don't really actually believe in God. And, you know, when you press them on it, they've sort of abstracted God out of existence. They say, oh, I believe in, It's like they're not willing to take that final step. They don't believe in any sort of personal God. They don't believe in a creator God. They don't believe in an interventionist God. You know, they believe in this some sort of abstraction of the ideas of love and goodness and so on. And they're just not willing to take that final step because, again, the idea of not believing in God is tremendously stigmatized. And it's a little distressing to me to hear people say we shouldn't even talk about this at all. I'm sorry if it's upsetting to you to hear these ideas, but these ideas are important. The idea of whether or not there is a God, this is an idea that matters. And if you're so disturbed by hearing people say, I don't believe in God, and here's why, here are my reasons why I've let go of it, then I have to ask you, do you care whether the things you believe are true? Do you care about whether God really exists? And if you do care about that, then why do you not want to hear people discussing why they don't believe?
Greta, I really thank you for the time.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you on the show. Teresa, I wish you well with whatever comes next. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you very much.
And from Mary online, she says, I've been an atheist for 42 years, have never felt like a maligned minority. I make no secret of my atheism, but feel no need to wave its flag. Steph Curtis will keep the conversation going at facebook.com/NPR News. And there is more of a focus on faith and public life coming later this week. So, Dana, have heart there. We're going to continue to talk about it. This is The Daily Circuit on Minnesota Public Radio News.